funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
There's a weird paradox in American politics. By and large, we can't stand Congress, but we feel good enough about our own representatives to keep sending them back there term after term. The rest of the bums, it seems, don't know or care what's good for us, but we know the folks we send from around here. We've seen them taking care of business, and we trust them. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Maybe our pessimism about the country as a whole and the direction it's moving in follows a similar pattern. We hear things aren't so great in other parts of the country, but we know our own communities well enough to believe they are getting better. And we're most inclined to feel that way if we are part of the effort to make it happen. James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic who witnessed this firsthand in extended reporting trips to 24 U.S. cities with shorter stays in 24 more. His article, How America is Putting Itself Back Together, is the cover story for the March issue of the magazine. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
If a lot of average Americans believe the country is in a state of decline, what is the source of that pessimism?
I think it must be some sense that whatever you're viewing in your own town, your own organization, your own state, you assume must be some kind of anomaly or outlier, because everything you hear from certainly political rhetoric over the past year or two is the country is going to hell. And the news coverage has there's a natural bias in the news to things that are going wrong. But I think there's been a sort of disproportionate bias over the last couple of years. So you think that you come to the conclusion that my wife Deb and I heard so many places, which is, we know America is failing, but here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, things are going in the right direction, or here in Greenville, South Carolina, or here in northern Mississippi, or here in Burlington, Vermont. So the point of this article was sort of to bring those two perceptions together, to recognize that local successes might not be 100% anomalous.
Let's listen to what some of those politicians have had to say in recent weeks.
Our nation is heading off the abyss of destruction.
The American people don't trust the federal government.
We have a planetary crisis.
We have a president who refuses to acknowledge the threat we face.
We are going to make America great again.
Those were candidates Dr. Ben Carson, Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Ted Cruz, and businessman Donald Trump. Jim, we listened to that, and it feels like these guys ought to know what they're talking about, right?
Yes, and let's peel back various of the layers here. One is whenever there's a presidential campaign, especially when there's an open seat, as there is, you know, the President Obama cannot run for re-election, it's in the nature of the out party, whichever party that is, to say that things are bad and getting worse. So that's something that is natural to the Republican dynamic now. There also is a very, very long-standing American tradition from the times of the Pilgrims onward to say, we're just about to fall apart. And the historical record is the very first sermon of this type, called a Jeremiad sermon, was preached in 1630 in Massachusetts, where the settlers were saying, oh, yeah, things were great back in 1620, but now we're letting the standards fall down. And I think also there is the fact that we have real problems. There is a global financial strain, as Senator Sanders was saying. Every country around the world is having the tensions that we're recognizing as a second Gilded Age. So I think it's we are so aware of the things that are going wrong that it's hard to keep them in mind at the same time with the ways in which parts of the United States are responding. We think, again, if it's happening in our university, our city, our company, well, that's good for us. But we assume every place else people are acting just as the objects of these forces.
So you have this little single engine prop plane, which you and your wife used to go all over the country in the course of 3 years. What was your agenda on the trip? And did your goals shift or clarify as time went on?
They did. And our agenda was that there were two background factors that had us start this trip about 3 years ago. One is we've been living in China for a long time. I've been reporting for The Atlantic from China. And one of the things we mainly did there was to get in a bus, get on a train, get on some regional airliner, and go to some remote part of the country and see what the perspective of China was if you weren't just in the big factories of southern China or the big shops of Shanghai. And the theme of what I was writing to Atlantic readers during that time was China is sort of less fearful the closer you get to it. and you see that it has some strengths, but also some really grievous weaknesses. So number one, we thought, what would that perspective be like if we applied it to the United States, not just looking at the big coastal cities, but the texture of the country? The other background factor is that for a long time, we have flown around the country in this little single-engine propeller plane, and there's a view of the country you don't get any other way. I would say it's like a sort of road trip taken to the nth power, because when you fly over the landscape, you can see how little of it actually is reachable by road. Mm. You know, the roads are these little ribbons, but there are little airports all over the place. And so we thought, let's go to places that you wouldn't otherwise go, whether it's Red Oak, Iowa, or Malta, Montana, or Chico, California, and try to ask in all these places that we tried to select for by saying they'd had some kind of pressure or shock or disappointment. How had they been able to respond? So I put an item on the Atlantic site about 3 years ago saying, tell us about your town. We got more than 1,000 people writing in saying, here's why this part of Alabama, this part of Missouri, this part of upstate New York is worth learning about. And we've been working our way down the list.
You know, this piece really resonated with me because I spent my teenage years and then part of my very young adulthood in El Paso, Texas, which is one of those cities. It's larger, it sounds like, than the targets of your trips. But it's one of those places that from the outside looks like nothing but a mess. But people from there see it growing and changing, maybe not in the way the rest of the country thinks it should be, but it's getting better over time.
And so I should disclose to your listeners right now that not only does one of my sons and his family live in your own Dallas, but I lived in Texas for a number of years. My wife got her graduate degree at UT Austin, and I worked for Texas Monthly when it was starting up. And in my Texas Monthly life, I traveled all over the state, including El Paso. I've been there a number of times. And as you say, it is the kind of place we're talking about, even though it's a little larger, in that people in the coastal metropoli would think, oh, El Paso, that's someplace in the middle of nowhere, as they would think also of Sioux Falls, which is a big place, or Fresno. And they get treated. The news comes there when there's something that goes wrong. In El Paso, when there's a border problem or a drug killing or whatever. In San Bernardino, California, which is where I'm from, when there's this terrorist shooting. Fresno, when there's some sitcom set there. But so we said, what would these places look like if you treated them as serious examples? And one other illustration, Greenville, South Carolina, has been in the news for the last 2 months, as it is every 4 years for the Republican presidential primary, because that's where Bob Jones University is, but actually it has a fascinating and very successful both economic story, downtown revival story, and also racial inclusion story. So we wanted to try to treat these places seriously and not just as scenes for political reporting or as objects of horror after there's some disaster.
Let's talk about San Bernardino, which it does have, you know, personal meaning to you. How did it come across in media coverage that followed the attack that really got the nation's attention?
So let me give you a little bit of background on San Bernardino. San Bernardino is arguably the worst off city in the United States, or at least it would be in a bracket with Gary or Flint or other places, in that it's a combination of economic blow after blow after blow. When I was growing up there, just right across the border in Redlands, San Bernardino had a big Air Force base and a steel mill, and there was an interstate that went through there, and there was a big railroad repair yard, and it was a very strong blue-collar city. All of those things have gone away, even the interstate. You know, the interstate got moved, which is a blow that most cities don't encounter. So it has a real sort of hollowing out of its economy. It also has a almost unique political logjam. The same paralysis that we associate with national-level politics in the United States applies on the city level there. And so you've had a really, really difficult situation in San Bernardino. And so when my wife and I were there last year, we spent most of last year based on the West Coast, and we were talking both about the problems and the people who were trying to change the city government, and some politically very conservative entrepreneurs who were training poor minority group of, you know, very poor household teenagers for higher wage jobs in the aerospace industry and as robotics repairmen and all that, a school system that was trying to improve itself. And so we thought the news in San Bernardino was how hard people were trying to figure a way ahead from a very difficult circumstance. But when you had thousands, well, at least hundreds of reporters from all around the world descending upon there for a couple of weeks after the shootings last December, there was one thing they were covering to the exclusion of everything else. And so I thought this is an unfortunate aspect of our media ecology, that it is all about any terrorist episode or a tornado or anything else, but not about the people who were living there before and the people who are still living there right now.
One of the things you write about in San Bernardino is as simple as these public cleanup projects, which sound like nothing, right? It sounds like something that every community should do, but it engages people with the community and with one another in ways that creates a benefit so far beyond just, you know, giving kids a cleaner place to play.
I'm glad you noticed that and mentioned it. There's a group called Generation Now in San Bernardino. These are people all in their 20s. Maybe there's one who's over 30. They are the city is mainly Latino, and this group is Latino and white and black. And they a couple of years ago, they came together and said, we are tired of being told that we live in the worst city in California and one of the worst cities in the country. Maybe we're being tired of told that we're losers, and if we stay, we're losers, and if we go away, we carry this loser label with us. And so the first thing they started to do was, as you say, just having they were painting very nice murals, you know, like sort of high-end graffiti on all these bombed-out buildings in the middle of downtown, and trying to make them sources of civic pride rather than embarrassment. They were picking up trash and needles and all the rest from the parks, including, many of your listeners may have seen after the shootings, the cops were dragging some lake to see if they could find some weapons that the shooters had used. And before that, the Generation Now people had tried to beautify this park, and they said that there was this palpable effect on citizens around there of saying, oh, yes, you know, this is a place we can take some pride in. We can think of things getting better. They're registering people to vote. Here's the point I'm getting to. If you asked people in San Bernardino, arguably the hardest hit place in the United States, are things getting better or worse there? I think all of them would say they're getting better. Hmm. You know, it's from a very low angle, but they're moving forward. And this coincides with the national level discourse of going straight into the abyss, which I think is inaccurate, or at least partially accurate, or only partially accurate.
Smaller communities understandably worry about brain drain. Can you talk about what you discovered was working in places that have managed to hang on to their best and brightest and even attract new talent? I'm thinking here about Duluth.
Yes. And so this is there's been a long historic pattern around the world in the United States of the big metropolises as the talent, as the magnets for a certain kind of talent. And we've heard in the last generation about how there's an even more thorough great sort going on, where Boston, New York, D.C., Seattle, San Francisco, L.A. attract the respective most ambitious people in those various fields, and Chicago, Dallas, Atlanta do as well. And that force is real. But also, we saw a powerful other force, where cities like Duluth in Minnesota and like Greenville in South Carolina and like Sioux Falls said that we can make it. We can attract people who have some reason to have us on the radar. There's some reason they're thinking of Sioux Falls, for example, because they're from the plains, or Duluth because they like this kind of outdoors life. And we can offer them an overall better life. The real estate is so much less expensive. We can offer the kind of community support. And so Duluth, which 100 years ago was a very prosperous city with iron ore shipping and grain and timber and everything else, and went into a very long decline, now has a kind of renaissance in aerospace technology with a leading plane company there, with medical technology, and with this outdoorsman company that exports to 60 countries around the world, because the founders there wanted to create a kind of life that their workers would enjoy.
We've
seen that in other places.
My guest is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic, who wrote the cover story for the March issue. It's called How America is Putting Itself Back Together. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
Like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Atlantic National correspondent James Fallows, who wrote the cover story for the March 2016 issue. It's called How America is Putting Itself Back Together. Jim, do you sing along with an MP3 or the radio or something in a prop plane the way you do in a car?
Actually, we do. There's a when we're flying a long stretch over the plains or the west, there's Sirius XM radio receivers. So we listen to NPR. We listen to farm reports. We listen to all kinds of things. We listen to music, too. And there is something exhilarating about, especially when you're flying through some clouds, of hearing, for example, Come Fly With Me by Frank Sinatra, or Looking for America, or any other theme music of that sort.
When you get on the ground in a place you haven't been before, what do you do? How do you start asking questions? How do you find the right people to talk to?
There's a long back. So in my now very long career as a reporter, the thing you learn how to do, as you know, is to you learn how to learn about things and mm-hmm. how you can ask people and size things up. In this process, we found a way. So we usually land at the little local small airport. There are 5,000 small airports around the country, and there's a culture called FBO culture, for fixed based operator, and there's a culture of these small airports. We find, we get either a loaner car from the airport, we get a taxi, we get an Uber, we go to a local motel, and then we have a way of sort of the usual suspects. Usually our first stop is at the local newspaper. And that's both to sort of pay respects to the people whose business is to learn about the community, to show that we're there to learn from them rather than to bigfoot them, and just to get some idea of what the layout of the town is. And then we go to the library, we try to talk to the mayor, we go to the schools, we try to see the big industries. Usually before we go someplace, we've had some connections with people who say, here's what's interesting about Columbus, Mississippi. Here is why Eastport, Maine is worth your attention. Here is why Winters, California is different from what you think, et cetera. So we have some initial connections. And the newspaper, usually our first question is often, you know, to either tell us the story of this city or tell us who the people are who make this place go, and then just follow the strands. But it's newspaper, library, schools, university, factories, churches, and out from there.
Many people think they have a picture in their minds of the problems in the Deep South. Tell us about how small communities along the Mississippi-Alabama border, of all places, have kind of rebranded themselves and changed their own self-identity.
Something that I think people who have not spent time in the South, as I have at various stages of my life, including part of my early childhood in Mississippi when my dad was in the Navy, I think that they have a sense that they know a true fact, which is that everything about the South is about its racial background, and they assume something from that, which is this: a topic people ignore or avoid. And so, on the one hand, it's true that white supremacists get disproportionate strength from deep South states. On the other hand, there's the longtime argument that is true that many Southern states wrestle more directly with their racial issues than some of the North does, just because it's a built-in part of their life. The places in Mississippi where we've gone repeatedly now are the triad of Columbus, West Point, and Starkville. They're in northern Mississippi, sort of across the Alabama border from Tuscaloosa. They call themselves the Golden Triangle, a term I had never heard before. And over the years, until about, say, 15 years ago, they'd been just one more poor area of Mississippi. There was some catfish farming, there was some cattle ranching, and a lot of really low-end manufacturing. For example, Columbus had a factory that made toilet seat covers. That was a big deal there. They had a place that made headstones for military cemeteries. And when that factory lost its contract, there was a guy who built his house out of unused headstones. And you see, you know, garden fences made out of headstones, et cetera, there. And a lot of those factories went away. They went to Haiti. They went to Mexico. And so the place was really in hard shape, in a hard time. And over the last dozen years, for reasons that involve public-private partnerships and the state government and black and white coalitions, you know, racially, they've brought in a very modern steel factory that pays people, you know, steel manufacturing wages of $70,000 or $80,000 a year, which is like more than double the household income, a helicopter factory for Airbus, a factory that makes these very advanced diesel engines for trucks, a number of there's a drone factory or something that does military technology there. And so if you ask people in this part of Mississippi, both are things getting better or worse? Are things getting better or worse racially, economically, culturally? They just say, oh, yeah, you know, the country's having trouble, but here in the Golden Triangle of Mississippi, we are moving the right direction, and including in the racial opportunities, because one of the local community colleges is treating people, largely both black and white, but a mixed workforce who had had either no jobs or had lost jobs for these high-wage manufacturing jobs in non-union factories, but they're coming back to this part of Mississippi. So they would say, America's in trouble, Mississippi moving forward.
One trend you noted just about everywhere was that places that were once very homogenous were seeing big changes in the numbers of immigrants in their communities. And communities, by and large, were adjusting pretty well.
Yes. The wonder here is that we all recall almost a year ago when Donald Trump came down his escalator and talked about Mexico was sending the rapists and all that. And since then, immigration has been a white-hot issue in the Republican side of the race. Until Trump entered the race, number one, public opinion polls conducted by Pew and other people showed that concern about immigration was maybe number 9 or number 12 in concerns that people had about the country. But it was something people were aware of, but it was not an emergency. And number two, what we saw in across the Midwest, where there's a very significant Latino presence through in Kansas and Iowa and South Dakota and elsewhere, and even in the North, where both Latino immigration and worldwide refugee absorption, these things were going on. They're changing the schools. They're changing the workforce. But if you hadn't heard the political rhetoric, you would think this was one more chapter and how the U.S. has always been evolving and always been affected by immigration. That is, it's always been a disruption, but only occasionally has it been an emergency. And most of the places in the U.S., it seems to be happening as a process with some adjustments that are required, but not this to the barricades, build the wall type of factor. And probably some of your listeners may not realize in the last 5 years, more Mexicans have left the United States than have entered. Just because of economic slowdown. And so on the city-by-city level, this has been perceived as a process but not a disaster.
You know, we understand that, as you well know, here in Texas because, you know, ideas and thoughts about immigration and what to do about it don't necessarily fall along political lines because if you live in Texas, you have, you know, lived and worked with a lot of immigrants.
Oh, it's true. And this was, you know, let's say 15 years ago, part of George W. Bush's argument when he was running to sort of rising to national prominence was that as a Republican in Texas, he came from a state that, in contrast to then California under Pete Wilson, had found a way to make Latino, Anglo and black relations part of life rather than this go to the barricades issue, which Pete Wilson had tried to do in California. I think California, which is where I'm from, has come a long way in that time. But the contrast between the Bush-era Republicans of Texas who had gone far to try to broaden their appeal across racial lines or ethnic lines and those in California who had not done that and therefore went into permanent eclipse or at least long-term eclipse as a political party in California, the Texas model of that time is what we've seen as almost the American model in most of the rest of the country. The mix is changing. It has always changed. And it doesn't seem to be really something that people by whom I mean the whites who were there before, are tremendously terrified by.
You write about a slaughterhouse in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that the community has absorbed a significant number of refugees from Burma and Somalia and Sudan and Nepal. And the slaughterhouse, which provides jobs for these people, is like this fascinating polyglot work environment.
If one wanted to do a documentary or a radio feature or a magazine article having one company as sort of a symbol of changes in a community and the nation, too, it might be this slaughterhouse that is right in the center of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. It's a strange thing to have this in the center of your town. The other thing in the center of their town is the state penitentiary, which is so Sioux Falls is a great city. They've cleaned up their natural fall. So the three things downtown are the slaughterhouse, the pen, and the falls. And so 80 or 90 years ago, this was a place where people would come in from the prairie and get their jobs in the big city, sort of in the Upton Sinclair era. Then for a long time, it was an immigrant place for Norwegians and Germans and East Europeans who were coming to the prairie, and they might not speak very good English, but this was a way in which it was unionized in those days, and they could make their way into the American middle class. Then about 25 years ago, there was a very, very bitter strike or union-busting showdown there. It became a non-union place. And the workforce there is still now absorbing immigrants, but they're largely refugees. So the work notices on the factory walls are in 30 languages. We didn't count them, but they said it was 30. And the people working there, it's both men and women. They are largely refugees. And so in this place where pigs are being sent from the livestock area to the market by the thousands per day, the people doing this are largely Islamic refugees, many of them women from Sudan, Somalia, people from Southeast Asia, from Pakistan, from Bhutan, from you name it. So this is the next saga, and their children are having their earnings from the slaughterhouse so they can get their start in life. And my wife told the story of this young woman from Darfur, whose mother works in a slaughterhouse, and she is going to Sioux Falls High School, whichever high school it was there, and joined ROTC. And her issue was on dress day for ROTC, uniform day, she was not allowed to wear her uniform to school like her other ROTC members because she had Islamic headwear on. And so South Dakota, the adjutant general there, changed the ruling to allow her to dress with the rest of her uniform, but with her Islamic as opposed to ROTC cap. And so she's now a proud member of the ROTC, joining her fellow classmates on dress day.
One interesting thing you noted, by the way, is that from the air, mega high schools and prison complexes look almost indistinguishable from one another.
Yes. It's here are the things you know about the U.S. if you're flying a little airplane. You realize that every big city is just ringed with quarries that you never see if you're on the road, but they're all over the place. That's where the roads come from. You see they're also ringed with prisons. And as you note, the prisons look very much like big high schools, because they have fences, and usually the prisons are a little farther away from the neighborhoods than the high schools are. But there's a first impression similarity.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Melanie in Dallas. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, Chris. Another great show. I'm really looking forward to reading the article. I also have a comment that leads to a question for your guest, and the comment is, I've lived all over the U.S. in my 60 years, but for the last 12 in Texas. Most of my family and friends, though, live either near or on one of the coasts in a big city, and I've spent 12 years whenever something gets reported about Texas or Dallas in the news, getting calls from friends and family saying, how can you live there? To which I've always answered, really, when you live here, it's not like that. And what I've discovered in the last 5 to 6 years in particular is that family and friends in Pittsburgh, Miami, New York, L.A., really all over the country, feel exactly the same way about their cities, that the often extreme and sometimes absurd reports that tend to get focused on in the media we all listen to, which, of course, leads with KERA for me, give you one impression of a place that really doesn't correspond to the impression people have when you live there. So my question for your guest is, I love your premise. I love the way you did the research. But if you focused on small cities, are you considering continuing to expand your research and include more parts of the country and perhaps bigger cities as well.
Thanks for your call.
I agree 100% with your observation, and you can even extend it. My wife and I have lived a lot of our life outside the U.S., and the view of the U.S. from the outside world is, how can you live there? You're going to be gunned down as soon as you walk down the street, and because the news they get is of shootings every single day, et cetera. And we understand that's part of the national fabric, and there's other things too. So to answer your question directly, yes, for the rest of this year, we're planning to do more travels in places we have relatively undercovered in a report so far, including Texas. So we will be there. We've been through Texas a lot, but we haven't done sort of a specimen study. We were at Marshall for a little while. I'll get into that. We've been to some bigger places, too. We're in Columbus, Ohio, which is quite a large city. We've been to Detroit and to Pittsburgh. So, yes, there's no way to cover the entirety of the American experience. But we're going to try to broaden this and then do a book starting late this year. But your main premise, I entirely agree with.
Tell us about Marshall.
Marshall, we came to for a very odd reason. For reasons too complex to explain, we've known Don Henley of the Eagles for a while. And we were living in China. We went to an Eagles concert in Beijing and then went out with him to a coal gasification plant, which he wanted to see. So we heard about his restoration project in Caddo Lake, which is right on the Texas-Louisiana border, and what he's trying to do to restore that. And so we spent a couple of days in Marshall, which has gone through ups and downs, as you know. So Marshall is the kind of place we may come back to, but we've mainly been out to the Caddo Lake wildlife area that Don Henley of your own Dallas has been putting a lot of his effort into, as he has at Walden Pond up in Massachusetts.
Is crisis the wrong word to use for the things that ail America? Everything we worry about, we call a crisis these days.
I guess there's lots of labels we have just because it's easier to use those than to say, to think of the more precise word. Here is the way I would describe the American condition right now. In every way except one, I think the United States is uniquely well-positioned in the world right now. We have a young population compared to other big countries because of immigration. We have the best universities in the world. We have the most fertile climate for new companies. We have a civic society that works pretty well, city by city. The problem we have is our national government. And that's not a crisis, but it is a very serious problem, which we can talk about after the break.
Sounds great. Thanks for setting that up. My guest is James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic. We're discussing his March article, How America is Putting Itself Back Together. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with The Atlantic's James Fallows, author of its cover story for March, How America is Putting Itself Back Together. Jim, I was so interested to hear what you were going to say is the one thing you really do have concerns about. It could have been gun violence, it could have been drugs, it could have been education. You said national government is the thing that really gives you pause.
Yes, that if you look around the world, that there are, it is a cliche to say that China is able to turn on a dime and build new airports or build more high-speed rail, and that the French have centralized national government and all the rest. The United States is uniquely strong in most ways. It's become uniquely paralyzed in its national government right now, where the checks and balances system we've had for a very long time, that it's been in many ways outdated by history, I would contend. When life tenure for Supreme Court justices was put in the Constitution, the average lifespan was 30 years shorter than it is now. When the two seats per state rule on the Senate was conceived, the gap between the most and least populous state was 10 to 1 as opposed to 70 to 1 that it is now. And there were norms that meant more or less we could keep functioning even with some antiquated rules. as the rules have gotten out of effect and as the norms have changed, where for the last few years, one of our political parties doesn't really care about governing but stopping things from happening, you have just a sense where it's hard to get things done at the national level. If something requires a national solution, it's going to occur only if there's a genuine emergency or the crisis that you mentioned. And so by default, I think most of the rest of the country is saying, well, let's see what we can do state by state, city by city, because it's not going to happen at the national level, even though that would be a more efficient way to do some of the things that should be done now.
How did we get to this place where there is so much resistance to compromise and the idea that, I think some people maybe despite their or regardless of their political affiliation are not really looking at this as a all for one and one for all proposition?
This is an answer that many of your listeners may disagree with, but I'll try to explain it as carefully as I can. And I'll bring my friend E.J. Dionne into the fray. He has a new book out called How the Right Went Wrong that argues to me convincingly that we're looking that both political parties have their problems, but there is an asymmetrical problem here where over, in the year since Barry Goldwater, the Republican Party has moved more away from the middle than the Democrats have. And you can illustrate this just by looking at the political race right now, presidential race. But you can also say that if you poll Republican Party representatives and voters, there's, say, 60% of the Democrats say they'd rather compromise and get half a loaf than not. And it's the reverse for the Republicans, where about 60% of today's Republicans say they'd rather not compromise, et cetera. So you have a dynamic within the Republican Party over the last generation of wanting to be purer and sort of propelling themselves more in a certain direction. And so, for example, there in Dallas, Congressman Sessions was challenged by somebody from his right rather than somebody from his left. So I think until this phase of the Republican Party runs its course and it becomes interested in governing once more at the national level, as it's forced to be at the state level. At the state level, you don't have the option of being just obstructionist. You have to get a budget passed, et cetera. At the national level, you do have the option of being obstructionist. So, as I say, many of your listeners may disagree, but that is my belief about what's happened.
You're candid that before you began this particular reporting project over 3 years, you were skeptical about the value of arts in making communities work better. I'm guessing you enjoy art, but you didn't necessarily think it mattered to a city.
You're being tactful and not quoting the line from my piece that begins, "I am a Philistine." So, yes, I'm a guy. I like the arts as much as anybody. But what I feel I know about is industrial engineering and software and all that kind of things. And so I had not really internalized the difference both in an emotional and morale way, but also in a tangible way that an arts community can make to an area. And so, for example, we talked about the town of Ajo, Arizona, which is this little middle-of-nowhere place that had an economic existence because of a copper mine. That mine just shut down, excuse me, and there was no reason for the city to be going anymore except that they're reinventing themselves as a beautiful destination resort for conferences and for artists and for painters and for poets and everything else. And there are enough places around the country that have made this work. You can see it happening there. Bigger cities like Pittsburgh are doing this. City of Fresno, California, which has been I won't name the cities I'm thinking of in Texas that you would think of as unstylish and unhip.
Thank you
Fresno
for not naming
that.
Those.
for my home state of California. And it's trying to restyle itself as the Bohemia of California because it's so affordable.
Yeah.
Artists can go there and for one-tenth the rent of San Francisco, they can have a studio, a theater company, and all the rest. So across the country, we saw this as a real focus of young people's energy, of economic activity, and all the rest.
Pittsburgh has made itself a haven for persecuted writers.
Yes, go figure. There's something called the Cities of Asylum, which I had not known about either before going to Pittsburgh, and it has a strong existence in Europe. In the U.S., there are two other university-based affiliates, but Pittsburgh, some civic leaders there decided they would make Pittsburgh a place where if you are a persecuted writer in Burma, if you're a Chinese poet who's run afoul of the authorities and you're in prison, if you're somebody from Venezuela, you should come to Pittsburgh. And from a previously somewhat shabby part of town called the Mexican War District, where the streets are named Battle of Veracruz and General Scott Street and things like that. They've allowed these artists to repaint these houses as their own little mini Chinas and mini Burmas. And they've made this a source of internationalization, a source of civic pride. They've had 250 events. It's become a big deal. So Pittsburgh, which has a great advanced technology existence now, and they've really sort of refashioned themselves. They also are trying to say that people think of, you know, Sweden or Switzerland as havens for the persecuted. They should think of Pittsburgh, too.
Jim, what did you learn about the way individual towns and small cities relate to neighboring communities? Is a sense of competitiveness a good thing? Is it a good thing for them to all sort of think of each other as siblings?
That's a really interesting question that I'll try to address more when I write more about this in the magazine, because it is natural that you find paired cities where each of them thinks of the other in a derogatory way. For example, in your own metroplex, you can think of such cities.
Right, and, absolutely.
And where I grew up, Riverside and San Bernardino had a very, very sort of a competitive relationship. And Riverside has been on the way up and San Bernardino has been on the way down. Duluth has its sister city of Superior, Wisconsin, right across a little body of water. And Duluth looks down on Superior. And there's a lot of this going on. And it is often the case that when they can pool their resources and their energy, they can do a lot more. And I think the Golden Triangle of Mississippi would be an example to everybody, because three cities that might be very weak separately have found a way to be strong together. In South Carolina, you find the cities of Greenville, Spartanburg, and Greer in between are also finding ways to pool their efforts. And so the big auto works for BMW that is there is among the three cities. The big airport is there. So I think that the rivalries are natural when they can find some way to harness that competitive energy but also use regional strengths. It's even better.
I'm sure that you have a healthy dose of skepticism when you visit these places, even if you are looking for good news stories. Were there things that people tried to show you when you came into town and said, I want to understand what's working, that you had to tell them that's not actually what I'm here to look at?
Sure. And there is the convention center, and you've seen one convention center, you've seen them all, and the Chamber of Commerce, why you should locate to City X in Missouri. I guess I was... And there are a couple places we went where we thought, gee, that's really not a very impressive town, including a couple I won't mention now in Georgia, but we'll write about later on. I guess I was struck that what I had feared, which is a kind of Babbitt-style boosterism, mm-hmm. of, you know, the great Sinclair Lewis book about Zenith City and how everybody was just boosting that, there was surprisingly little of that. And if we asked people to show us a startup zone, show us an interesting public school, show us a community college, show us a craft brewery, show us a library. These were tangible things, and either they would sort of make the cut or would not. And there are a lot of cities where the civics story is still that it's headed downhill, a lot of them in West Virginia, where it's still a downhill story. But generally, if you ask for things that are specific, there's a library that's in good shape or it's not. And that there was not that much of the kind of just sheer real estate boosterism that as I might have feared.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Eddie on the line in Dallas. Hello, Eddie.
Hey, thanks. Mr. Fellows, I am shocked to say you and I met about 33 years ago when I was a student activist at the University of Texas. So the first thing I want to say is something I was too stupid and young to say then, and that is thank you for your lifelong body of work. I think it's been amazing.
Well, you're very nice to say that. We really enjoyed our two stints of living in Austin, and we like Dallas too.
One other quick thing: there's a Golden Triangle in Texas you might want to look at for your next work too, and that's the Beaumont, Port Arthur, Orange area. Pretty fascinating history and culture there as well. My question is: I see a disappearance of the kind of long form journalism that you have done so well over the years. Do you agree with this disappearing, and what do you think the long-term implications for that are? And then how does somebody pay for the kind of journalism that you do? So thank you, and I'll listen.
So thanks very much, and thanks for getting together long ago when we lived in Austin. So as everyone knows, the journalism business, just as a business, has gone through contortions in the last 20 years, and it's been in contortions as long as journalism has existed. I'm happy to say that The Atlantic is generally looked at now as a successful example of how you can reposition yourself, because we are now a commercially significantly profitable business. It's a combination of our website, which is very large, and an events business we have with ideas, festivals, and things. And our magazine has a strong print advertising business and strong print circulation. The trends, the long-term trends for print are challenging, as we put it. So I think that it is, we spend all of every day thinking how we can keep this business going. And I think that even though the magazine business is a shadow of its former self, if you look at all the different media that are supporting long-form reporting, there is more of it going on than you might think, but just in different forms. So I think to be in the journalism business is to just – it's like sort of being a whitewater canoer, where there's – you dodge this boulder and there's a next one ahead, and we just keep on going. The way that our project in particular is paid for is that I have a salary from The Atlantic. My wife has had a very, very modest sort of per piece fee she's gotten. And we've gotten advertising contracts from people who said, okay, we'll pay the gas expenses and your Motel 6 for a week if you can give us another week's worth of reports from the Midwest. So we are grateful to these advertisers, and that's how we've been doing it.
Living the high life at the Motel 6.
Yes. We once lived in a shipping container for a week, but that's a whole different story.
Is The Atlantic deliberately an incubator for book-length journalism, or does it just work out that way?
I think it just works out that way. That the kind of people who are our sorts of writers, there's a, you know, our stories are plenty long, but even so, there's a lot you have to leave out. So I think it's just a natural cast of mine. People who like doing this kind of thing like writing books too. And my friend Ta-Nehisi Coates is sort of the most recent example of that.
If you had to select one of the places you visited for this project to live for, let's say you couldn't leave for 2 years, is there a city that you could instantly name?
It's like, you know, which is our favorite child? and we love them all. I guess Greenville, South Carolina is really an attractive place, and so is Bend, Oregon, and Central Oregon, and so is Fresno in its way, and we still haven't come to Texas in a serious way. And if Burlington, Vermont weren't so cold, that would be, and I guess I would say Duluth. Duluth is cold, but I really love Duluth, and there's something so majestic about the scenery there. So the places I've just named are the ones that would first, they're the children I love even more than the others.
And here, of course, you can give a shout out to the Dallas child that you have.
I say hi to my son Tad, his wife Annie, and their children Jack and Eleanor. I hope Jack and Eleanor are at school and in bed, respectively, and that Tad and Annie are at their places of work. But we really much really enjoy. We spent Christmas with them, and we'll see them again in a couple weeks.
James Fallows is a national correspondent for The Atlantic. His article, "How America is Putting Itself Back Together," is the cover story for the March issue. Jim, it's been such a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for making this time for us.
Chris, the pleasure is mine. Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phones today from Tori Whitley. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.